regarding my brother who lives in North Carolina. A year and a half ago, he was in actually a series of bad motorcycle accidents, but one that injured him rather severely, and he has had some complications and is actually facing the possibility of having his right leg amputated. And so things are looking iffy there. So we're in communication with him and trying to figure out how to support him.
I'll go.
I'm Chris. This is a joy. People at my work are always talking about, what are you going to do over Christmas or over the vacation? And I'm not going anywhere because my kids are home, and I'm so happy. Julia came back from Italy, and Kate's with us, and I couldn't be happier. Just make me at home, and I finally feel like I've gotten to the place where I like being at home now completely, so it's going to be a great holiday.
Our three-year-old Blake is going to start preschool, and I'm ready, but also so not ready.
A very quick joy. I am in a play with Reverend Jason and his husband Lawrence and another congregant, Carlos Lopez. And there'll be flyers in the back. It is Murder on the Nile at Stages Theater about a month from now, for a month. So come and see us. It's fun. Agatha Christie.
And I'm going to invite our worship associate to light a candle for all those folks who are struggling and facing challenges at our border. And so this is both a sorrow, concern, but also a joy, because today we will be sharing half our plate with the San Diego Rapid Response Network, who help people there at the border. And so I'm very happy that we're able to do that in these times. As always, we know that the joys and sorrows that were spoken in this room only begin to scratch the surface of what might be happening in our lives. And so we hold everything that remains unspoken in our hearts and minds. As you have probably figured out this morning, we are theming our service around a tribute to the wisdom of Rod Serling. Rod was a dedicated Unitarian Universalist for most of his life, actually, member of our Santa Monica congregation for many years. And much of the work that he did came out of his understanding of his identity as a UU. And so I thought it would be a useful thing to begin some of delving into the wisdom of Rod Serling by having folks share some quotations about him this morning. So if you have a quotation about Rod that you were given earlier from him, I invite you to come forward at this time and share it. So it'll just be kind of an informal thing here as we, if you want to line up down the aisle, that's fine. Let Barbara say.
Imagination, its limits are only those of the mind itself.
The worst aspect of our time is prejudice, man's seemingly palpable need to dislike someone other than himself.
According to the Bible, God created the heavens and the earth. It is man's prerogative and woman's to create their own particular and private hell.
Being like everybody is the same as being nobody.
We're developing new citizenry, one that will be very selective about cereals and automobiles, but won't be able to think.
I have found that it was all right to have Martians say things Democrats and Republicans could never say.
Any state, any entity, any ideology that fails to recognize the worth, the dignity, the rights of man, that state is obsolete.
Human beings must involve themselves in the anguish of other human beings. This, I submit to you, is not a political thesis at all. It is simply an expression of what I would hope might be ultimately a simple humanity for humanity's sake.
For civilization to survive, the human race has to remain civilized.
Thank you. There are tools of conquest, and they do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men.
It has forever been thus, so long as men write what they think, then all of the other freedoms, all of them, may remain intact. And it is then that writing becomes a weapon of truth, an article of faith, and an act of courage.
All of the Dachaus must remain standing. The Dachaus, the Belsens, the Buchenwalds, and the Auschwitzes, all of them. They must remain standing because they are a monument to a moment in time when some men decided to turn the earth into a graveyard. Into it they shoveled all of their reason, their logic, their knowledge, but worst of all, their conscience. And the moment we forget this, the moment we cease to be haunted by its remembrance, then we become the grave diggers.
The ultimate obscenity is not caring, not doing something about what you feel, not feeling.
There is nothing in the dark that isn't there when the lights are on.
This is not a new world. It's simply an extension of what began in the old one. It has patterned itself after every dictator who has ever planted the ripping imprint of a boot on the pages of history since the beginning of time. It has refinements, technological advances, and a more sophisticated approach to the destruction of human freedom. But like every one of the superstates that preceded it, it has one iron rule. Logic is an enemy, and truth is a menace, and has been for 40 years.
If you write, fix pipes, grade papers, lay bricks, or drive a taxi, do it with a sense of pride. And do it the best you know how. Be cognizant and sympathetic to the guy alongside, because he wants a place in the sun too. And always, always look past his color, his creed, his religion, and the shape of his ears. Look for the whole person. Judge him as the whole person.
Somewhere between apathy and anarchy lies the thinking human being.
The writer's role is to menace the public's conscience. He must have a position, a point of view. He must see the arts as a vehicle of social criticism, and he must focus on the issues of the time.
Let us move into a time of reflection and prayer. Despair is my private pain, born from what I have failed to say, failed to do, failed to overcome. Be still my inner self. Let me renew my life. Let me turn to the world, the streets of the cities, the worn tapestries of brokerage firms, crack dealers, private estates, personal things in the bag lady's cart, rage and pain in the faces that turn from me, afraid of their own inner worlds. This common world I love anew. as the lifeblood of generations who refuse to surrender their humanity in an inhumane world courses through my veins. From within this world, my despair is transformed to hope, and I begin anew the legacy of caring. Let us share a moment of silence. As we look toward the twilight, let us not forget to hope for the dawn. May it be so.
Thank you, gentlemen. Guitar life goals right there. All right, so Nicholas Parisi. The question of whether Rod Serling was a religious man is often asked. Serling's explicit answers to that question and the answers that are implicit in his work are complicated. He was born into a Reformed Jewish family, and he later joined Unitarian congregations, first in Ohio, and then in California when the family relocated there. Unitarian Universalism is a liberal faith, as we know, that defies easy definition. The tenets of Unitarian Universalism would certainly have meshed well with Serling's beliefs. The Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Santa Monica, where the Serlings attended, declares its vision: to create and nurture a community where the search for truth is free and unhindered, where the dignity, worth, and rights of every individual are revered, where spiritual, emotional, and intellectual growth are stimulated and encouraged, where the process is open and democratic, where our interdependence with all life on earth is recognized and honored, and where the transforming power of love is acknowledged. Serling had embraced these tenets long before he moved to California. In his 1946 application to Antioch College, he summarized his attitudes toward religion in terms with which many Unitarians would sympathize. "I dislike the institution of organized religion, preferring a personal sort of belief, including personalized worship. I believe in God, in a certain code of moral ethics, excessively liberal in some eyes, perhaps, and consider the modern conception of racial groups a harmful creation of unnatural barriers between human beings that need not exist. Unitarian Universalist congregations, which purport to welcome people of all faiths and those of no faith, implicitly proceed from the premise that religious distinctions similarly qualify as unnatural barriers between human beings that need not exist." Serling's former Reverend Ernest Pipes of the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Santa Monica said, "Theologically speaking, Rod was what we call a naturalistic humanist. By definition, naturalistic humanists tend to accept that supernatural claims, such as whether God exists or whether there is an afterlife, are unverifiable and therefore should not be presented as more than personal opinions." In 1972, Serling summarized his beliefs in terms that echoed his college application essay with an added measure of humanism: "I'm not religious in the orthodox sense, but I have strong beliefs. I believe in God, but I think I believe in man more. I have to believe in man because that's where it is. And if we don't do it, no one else shall. And we've got such a long way to go. The problems are seemingly so totally insurmountable." So, in short, Serling believed that humans have to work to solve the world's problems, a viewpoint he distilled as, "If you want to prove God is not dead, first prove man is alive."
Submitted for your approval. I had to start that way, right? A kitchen in Cincinnati, Ohio, the heart of Middle America, land of apple trees and apple pie. There sits a young man, an undistinguished staff writer at a radio station. Not an important radio station or an important young man or an important kitchen table. But it's at that table where late into the night he works, writing plays for television and radio. Later, we find ourselves in another kitchen, this time among the tall buildings and noisy engines of New York. And there's that same man. More screenplays, more ideas. This time, awards. 3 Emmys for 3 teleplays, hard-hitting social conscience dramas. This is the young man who would soon court a place he would call the Twilight Zone. In 1957, fresh from his initial New York television success, Rod Serling and his wife, Carol, moved to California to devote themselves to the burgeoning Hollywood television industry. Serling said that of all the media, TV lends itself most beautifully to presenting a controversy. The writer's role is to menace the public's conscience. He must see the arts as a vehicle of social criticism, and he must focus on the issues of the time. Now, much of Serling's social conscience was developed through his identity as a Unitarian Universalist, though, as we heard, he grew up in a culturally Jewish household. Still, in high school,
He experienced anti-Semitism when he was blackballed from a fraternity. Likewise, his time in the United States Army, where he was eventually awarded the Purple Heart, caused him to question humanity, ultimately leaving him, quote, bitter about everything and at loose ends. The war flashbacks, nightmares, and insomnia would haunt Serling his whole life and make their way repeatedly into his work. At Antioch College in Ohio, Serling found a liberal intellectual environment, sparking the need to write, a kind of compulsion, as he called it, to get some of my thoughts down. And the words of Unitarian educator Horace Mann, first president of Antioch College, also inspired him. Be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity. Serling would later feature these words and a rendition of Antioch's Horace Mann statue in the 1962 Twilight Zone episode, Changing of the Guard. During his first year at Antioch, Serling met his future wife, Carol Kramer. Shortly before their marriage, Carol and Rod both converted to Unitarianism, an easy transition in the liberal environment at Antioch, which had Unitarian connections going back nearly a century. Rod Serling would thereafter identify as a Unitarian Universalist. In Hollywood, he drew on his progressive Unitarian beliefs to craft scripts that contained controversial messages that directly tackled social ills. But corporate sponsors pushed back. And so then did the networks. In 1959, he expressed his frustration. I think it's criminal that we're not permitted to make dramatic note of social evils that exist, of controversial themes as they are inherent in our society. So this obstacle wasn't necessarily a bad thing for us. For if Serling's hard-hitting television dramas had been embraced, we might never have had the story of the boy who wishes people into the cornfield, or the alien race that attempts to serve up humanity for dinner through a cookbook. The man who just wanted time to read all those books, if only he had his glasses. Or that beautiful woman undergoing yet another surgery to look more like the not-so-beautiful people around her. I could go on and on. We have these stories because of the hostile environment Serling found himself in. He learned that advertisers would routinely approve stories tackling controversial issues like racism or religious intolerance if they took place on another planet. So he began to work in the science fiction and fantasy genres, giving life, of course, to the iconic television series, The Twilight Zone. But why devote a Sunday morning to Rod Serling? Because when it comes to 20th century Unitarian Universalists, there was probably nobody else who had such a wide platform to share their ideas. Unitarian Ralph Waldo Emerson could not even have dreamed of a platform like Serling's, a magic box in every home that told stories, stories that went so deep they've now become part of the American mythos, arguably better known nowadays, and look up religious literacy statistics if you don't believe me, better known nowadays than even stories from the Bible. Much as Unitarian authors like Louisa May Alcott or Henry David Thoreau did, Serling channeled his Unitarian Universalist beliefs into stories, this time for television. Stories that for all their black and white qualities, limited gender roles, and other trappings of their era, still nonetheless pack a punch today. Perhaps they've had such lasting impact because Serling, similar to great theologians who came before him, was so honest about the tensions he felt in trying to make meaning of the world, so willing to wrestle publicly with just what it means to be human. And so no wonder that he found a home in Unitarian Universalism during the most creative years of his career and beyond. Now, there's always been an underlying optimism in Unitarian Universalism, the belief that human actions can make a difference in building a better world. Yet the other side of putting so much faith in humanity means that we are also at the mercy of humanity's worst qualities. If whatever God there might be or might not be is not going to intervene and save us, then our job is to save ourselves, often from ourselves. Serling wrestles with this complicated notion in countless teleplays. In, for instance, the classic episode, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, residents of a typical suburban middle-class neighborhood are concerned that an alien invasion has taken place, and perhaps even a resident of Maple Street is secretly an alien. This seemingly idyllic American street quickly devolves into a place of division and destruction, pitting neighbor against neighbor. The twist ending reveals that an alien race is simply created, the general circumstances for humanity to begin destroying itself on their own, letting our own worst inclinations run wild. Prejudices can kill, and suspicion can destroy, Serling says in the closing narration. We need only look at the crisis at our border to see similar dynamics being played out in the country today, sometimes resulting in spectacular failures, such as we've seen with the death of the 7-year-old migrant girl in U.S. custody just this week. This is one reason we are sharing our plate with the San Diego Rapid Response Network today. Serling repeatedly grappled with questions we still haven't figured out the answers to. Who is our neighbor? Who do we trust? Who is the other? Who's really in power? Over and over, Serling explored the human response to fear. It was Thomas Hobbes who said that humans are primarily motivated by fear. Fear of each other that drives us to form societies that supposedly serve to protect. Fear has always been interwoven with politics, going back to Machiavelli, who said, "It is better to be feared than loved." Serling had a similar perspective as Hobbes, often exploring the modern capitalist rat race and how this dispersion of power affects issues of conformity, ageism, lookism, fascism, tyranny, dictatorship, and so on. As we know all too well, none of these concerns have gone away in the last decades, which is perhaps one of the reasons his work remains as popular as ever, including a new revival series in the works. Yet while Serling offers valid, pointed critiques of humanity, and he worked hard to make us aware of ourselves at our worst, including the idea that our best selves do not always prevail, he also believed in the value of the critique itself. The very fact that he bothered to critique conveyed a glimmering of hope amidst the darkness. You know, it's like when people respond to criticisms of American policy by saying, "Well, love it or leave it," not understanding that the criticism is offered because those who offer it love it and can see just what the potential is. Serling, I believe, felt much that way about humanity. We are flawed, ever inclined to give in to our selfish natures, but yet redemption is available to us. But we have to work for it. And that requires a lot of difficult self-reflection. The Twilight Zone, then, is not an external place. It's within each and every one of us, the place where our best instincts meet our worst. As he said at Moore Park College in 1968, what a fitting quote, too, this is at this point as we look toward the winter solstice, longest night of the year. "Men do not die of the darkness. They die of the cold. It is the frost that kills them." And what in Serling's eyes was the antidote to that frost? Community. "That's what the dream is," he said. "That's what it's all about, the oneness of humanity." In today's ever-divisive world, we look to a figure like Serling because not only did he share the values of his faith community, but he also showed persistence when he met resistance. He found new ways to tell stories when people refused to hear them the way he first tried to tell them. His work's progressive messages, tempered by pragmatism, built bridges of communication across religion, political parties, age, and gender differences, and that is no small feat, as we know. Many of us nowadays are wondering, how do we bridge that gap in our current national discourse? This week, I was working with the mental health workers on strike with Kaiser Permanente. What struck me is that each person I spoke with was there because of their concerns about patient care. We're talking people waiting months for a mental health appointment, people being over-medicated because it was easier to get into a doctor for a prescription than it was to see a therapist, people being sent off to group therapy when what they needed was one-on-one treatment. These workers were fed up with not being able to provide the care that was needed. What struck me in listening to their stories was, how could anyone disagree with that? Who among us, I mean, whoever we are, however we identify, who would really want that treatment for other people? And yet, of course, we know there are corporate forces at work resisting the concerns of these folks. And when I read the comments under news stories about the strike this week, it's always a mistake to read those comments, but there were a large number of people who just didn't get it. Clearly, strikes and direct reporting, as important as these things are, aren't quite enough to change hearts and minds. In the days ahead, I hope we will continue to look at people like Serling and other artists who historically have pricked the American social conscience, because I think we need that now in this time as much as we ever have. In a few days, we enter the longest night of the year. And then we know there will be light after that. There always has been. But it's also an opportunity for us to think metaphorically. What would the world be like if the light didn't return? How do we ensure that there is always light? I believe it's the times of twilight that are our best opportunities for reflection. Not dazzled by the brilliance of daylight, where we believe that all will be well forever, and not depressed by the depth of night's darkness, where we lose track of hope. It's in twilight, in the time of filtered light and shadows, in the creep of coming darkness, that we find the best view of ourselves, of humanity in all its gifts and flaws. Serling said, I think the destiny of all men is to not sit in the rubble of their own making, but to reach out for an ultimate perfection which is to be had. At the moment, it's a dream, but we have it within our power to make it a reality. And how would Serling describe the reality of America today? Something like this, I think. The United States, time, the present, mood, divided. While little Timmy still plays baseball down at the park and Mary colors in her coloring book, the powers that be are waging a war. Sometimes loud, but often as quiet as the sound of a pen scratching a signature across a paper. A struggle that threatens to cross the line between the shining hope of a nation and the dark brutality of selfishness. All these people, the farmers and the bankers and the teachers and the store clerks and the doctors, they didn't know they would be here, but here they are, in this place between daylight and nighttime, when the dreams of a country, all the hopes and ideals and substance that gives it its fiber will be called into question. And the question for all of humanity, the question whose answer will forever inform the lives of little Timmy and Mary, is whether they go back to the light or go deeper into the dark.
This is an open question, explored best, but finitely. So time is of the essence in the twilight zone.
Let us use the time of twilight to see ourselves for who we are and who we could be. For we control our journey, both into and out of the darkness.
Imagine, if you will, as the offertory plate comes around, half of our offer once a month goes to a great cause. This week this month is the San Diego Rapid Response Network to help those seeking asylum and refuge at our southern border. The greatest need of refugees from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador is for cash to assist with legal and transportation costs. Please give generously.
For our closing song, we will be singing Imagine. So please rise in mind, body, or spirit and join us in singing. Oh, sorry. I totally played that in the wrong key. That would make a huge difference. Imagine there's no heaven. Thank you.
we extinguish this chalice, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. Would you please join hands for our closing words? After the darkness comes the dawn. Let us remember it as our responsibility to create that journey toward the dawn. Let us use the time of twilight and our imaginations and our spirit to kindle a journey that is filled with hope. Until we meet again, amen.
Shalom, salam, namaste, and blessed be.
Go now in peace.